Hello, listeners. Thank you for tuning in to Iris. This is the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 1st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Let's jump right into the weather forecast update, this coming from KCRG. A break before more rain and storms tonight into Thursday. An overall active weather pattern continues, but we'll catch some breaks from wetter weather from time to time. A mix of sun and clouds will be present for most of the day today, with some break in between allowing sunshine to make its way through. These clouds and northwesterly winds will be the factors working against a bigger warm-up, but with a warmer start to the day and enough of that sunshine, we should still hit the upper 60s to low 70s in most cases. Precipitation should mostly hold off during daytime hours too, making for an overall pleasant start to the month of May. As clouds continue to increase this evening, a few showers could start to develop. They'll be pretty widely scattered initially, but the potential for a gradual uptick in the number of them is there heading through the night. Temperatures tonight will fall into the mid-50s as winds shift to the northeast. Storm activity becomes more likely toward daybreak and beyond on Thursday morning, so plan on a fairly wet start to the work and school day. This should remain decently widespread for the rest of the day, though occasional breaks will be possible. The chance for rain doesn't really wind down until a cold front sweeps through the area, either late in the evening or early Friday morning, pushing the moisture off to the east. While widespread severe weather looks unlikely on Thursday, a few storms could be strong to even just over the threshold to be considered severe. An incident or two of hail, high wind, or a brief tornado could take place. This risk could increase somewhat if we caught a more substantial break from rainfall and saw a little sunshine. Right now, this outcome looks very unlikely. What does appear more likely is a decent amount of rainfall throughout the day. The feed of moisture into this storm system will be pretty steady, so rainfall rates could be moderate to even heavy at times. A band of an inch or higher totals could easily take shape, especially for those who get those repeated rounds of activity. Looking at Friday, it represents another pretty excellent day with a good amount of sunshine, lighter winds, and temperatures in a really comfortable range. Lows will be in the upper 40s to low 50s, and highs reach for the upper 60s to low 70s. For early May, it's tough to beat that. The next disturbance in the weather pattern is quick to follow, though, with a chance for some showers on Saturday. These should be fairly light if they take place, and there should be a decent amount of dry time between them. Highs will be held back a little bit more due to the precipitation and clouds, with low to upper 60s likely for nighttime. That won't be the end of our on-again-off-again rain chances. After another break with some great weather on Sunday, more rain chances arrive on Monday. They'll become even better chances for later Monday into Monday night, with some of that lingering into Tuesday. Another chance arrives on Wednesday, though that one looks a little less certain from this standpoint several days away. Now let's turn to the local news stories on the front page of today's Courier. The top story is titled, One for the Record Books. Iowa and Nebraska hit Friday by the strongest tornadoes in a decade. Story written by Julie Anderson of the Omaha World Herald. And it begins with a photograph of the cleanup operation where friends and family and co-workers help clean up the damage. And we see in the photograph an excavator using its bucket to pick up the chassis of a destroyed mobile home. The images of splintered homes and farms leave little doubt about the ferocity of the tornado-spawned storms that battered eastern Nebraska and western Iowa on Friday. But information released Monday by the National Weather Service, Omaha office, indicates they were the most powerful storms to hit the area in the past 10 years. Dozens of reported tornadoes wreaked havoc Friday in the Midwest, destroying and damaging at least 150 homes in Omaha alone. The National Weather Service in Des Moines on Monday confirmed 24 tornadoes developed in Iowa on Friday. The Weather Service said 16 of those were in the central or southern Iowa, with 8 in far western Iowa. 4 tornadoes in western Iowa were rated at EF3, with peak wind speeds of 136 to 165 miles per hour. In its preliminary assessment, the Omaha office has tallied 10 tornadoes within its coverage area. 5 of those were rated at EF3 on the enhanced Fujita scale, 2 were rated at EF2, and 3 listed as EF1. The EF3 tornadoes were the strongest to strike the area since an EF3 landed near Coleridge, Nebraska, on June 17, 2014, according to the report. Quote, "We haven't seen tornadoes this strong in our area for a decade," said Brennan Dara, a meteorologist with the Omaha office. Despite the strength and number of storms, the only fatality was an Iowa man who was hurt during Friday's tornado in Minden, according to the Pottawatomie County Emergency Management Agency. First responders found 63-year-old Nicholas Ring unconscious and transported him to Nebraska Medical Center, where he later died. Officials in Nebraska and Iowa have reported 36 injuries, most of them minor. Damage in western Iowa was concentrated in the Minden area. On Monday, Iowa Governor Kim Reynolds issued a disaster proclamation for 8 additional counties in response to Friday's severe weather. The governor's proclamation allows state resources to be utilized to respond to and recover from the effects of this severe weather and activates the Iowa Individual Assistance Grant Program and Disaster Case Advocacy Program for the following counties: Clark, Crawford, Harrison, Mills, Polk, Ringgold, Shelby, and Union. A disaster proclamation was issued for Pottawatomie County on Friday. The tornado that ravaged part of Elkhorn, Nebraska, before crossing the Missouri River into Harrison County, was on the ground for more than 31 miles and reached peak wind speeds of 165 miles per hour. At its widest, this tornado was 1,600 yards wide, according to the Weather Service, or nearly 1 mile. Another that developed near McClelland in Pottawatomie County was on the ground for nearly 41 miles to the Defiance and Harlan area of Shelby County, reaching peak wind speeds of 160 miles per hour. That tornado ripped through Minden, destroying more than 50 homes in that small town. In a news conference, Nebraska Governor Jim Pillen said the state does not have preliminary damage figures yet, but some 500 homes were damaged or destroyed, including a number of high-value properties. Pillen also estimated that 4 hangars were destroyed at Omaha's Epley Airfield, which will cost $1.5 million each to replace. Restoring electricity and fixing damage to electrical infrastructure will likely top $6 million. Other costs, including clearing roadways of debris, law enforcement officials have been providing security in damaged neighborhoods. To help assess damage, officials said the Federal Emergency Management Agency has contracted for Civil Air Patrol to conduct imaging flights over the tornado path. Nebraska Emergency Management Agency Assistant Director Irv Portis said it will take several days before all data are fully collected. In its assessment of the storm's power, the Weather Service said crews have surveyed all of the stronger tornadoes that struck the region, but Dara said the agency is still working to assess smaller ones. Quote, "The total number of tornadoes will certainly go up," said Dara, who called the event, quote, "one for the record books." The tornadoes the Omaha office surveyed combined for a total track length of 162.5 miles and were on the ground for a total of 4 hours and 51 minutes, according to the Omaha office's report. The maximum wind speed based on ground level damage assessments was 165 miles per hour. The maximum single tornado track length was 40.9 miles. Two tornadoes were up to a mile wide at some point. The tornadoes were spawned by storms known as supercells, which go through cycles. They can strengthen and spin out a tornado, then weaken and later form again to produce more, Dara said. One Nebraska supercell tracked from Wilbur through northeast Lincoln and the Waverly area, where it produced one EF3 tornado that struck the Garner Industries plant, where 70 employees were sheltered. It collapsed the roof of the plant and 3 walls. A separate storm produced an EF3 tornado that developed just east of the Epley Airfield runway, destroying several aircraft hangars and aircraft, and then crossed the river and damaged homes south of Crescent. It continued northeast and dissipated in a field just north of the Harrison-Pottawatomie County line. A third storm produced 2 EF3 tornadoes, one that started in southwest Iowa and came within a mile or two of McClelland, and another that struck Minden before tracking as far as Harlan and Defiance, cutting a path nearly 41 miles long. Quote, at the National Weather Service, the meteorologist wrote, our hearts are with all those impacted, including our friends, our neighbors, and everyone who has been affected by these devastating tornadoes, unquote. Farm field planting disrupted by storms. Severe weather leaves 4.2 days suitable for field work. This story was written by the Courier staff, and the dateline is Des Moines. Although last week began with dry weather, by Friday, severe storm systems brought cooler temperatures and rain. The U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Agricultural Statistics Service says that allowed Iowa farmers just 4.2 days suitable for field work during the week ending Sunday. The storms also brought tornadoes and hail to areas of the state. Corn, soybean, and oat planting advanced early in the week, but came to a halt for most as the storms arrived. Quote, our hearts go out to the Iowans and communities that suffered damage caused by the severe weather over the weekend, Iowa Secretary of Agriculture Mike Nagy said in a news release. Quote, as they begin a long process of recovering and rebuilding, the outpouring of support from fellow Iowans is a reminder of how truly special our state and its people are. The widespread weekend rain will likely pause some planting progress, but with an active weather pattern continuing as we head into May, farmers will be eager to get back in the field when conditions are right, unquote. Corn planted reached 39% complete, 4 days ahead of last year, and 3 days ahead of the 5-year average. 2% of the expected corn crop has emerged. 25% of the expected soybean crop has been planted. That's 4 days ahead of last year and 5 days ahead of the average. 90% of the expected oat crop has been planted, 5 days ahead of last year and 9 days ahead of the 5-year average. 53% of the oat crop has emerged, 8 days ahead of last year. Pastures and hay ground continued to green up, but warmer temperatures would aid in growth. Reports were received of cattle being turned out into pasture. Several waves of severe thunderstorms spawned multiple strong tornadoes, causing significant damage across portions of western and central Iowa late in the reporting period, according to Justin Glisson, state climatologist with the Iowa Department of Agriculture and Land Stewardship. This active storm track also brought much-needed rainfall across the drought region, along with reports of hail and high winds. Unseasonably warm conditions persisted with positive departures of up to 4 degrees over southern Iowa. The statewide average temperature was 53.9 degrees, and that's 2 degrees above normal. Weekly precipitation totals ranged from 1/10 of an inch at Guttenberg Lock and Dam to 4.72 inches in Little Sioux, that's in Harrison County. The statewide weekly average precipitation was 1.32 inches, while the normal is 0.91 inches. Iowa City reported the week's high temperature of 84 degrees on April 27th. That's 18 degrees above average. Several northern stations reported the week's low temperature of 25 degrees on April 22nd, on average 12 degrees below normal. 4-inch soil temperatures range from the lower 50s northwest to low 60s in the southeast as of Sunday. Powerball win puts a spotlight on an immigrant culture. $1.3 billion winner, part of Lou Maine people, who settled in the U.S. after Vietnam War. This story comes from the Associated Press and begins with a photograph of Chen, known as Charlie Saipan, and he's holding a display check above his head, which is including the amount of $1.3 billion. The dateline is Portland, Oregon. Chang, known as Charlie Saipan, wore a broad smile and a bright blue sash emblazoned with the words Lou Maine, USA, as he hoisted an oversized check for $1.3 billion above his head. The 40-year-old immigrant's luck in winning an enormous Powerball jackpot in Oregon, a lump sum payment of $422 million after taxes, which he and his wife will split with a friend, changed his life. It also raised awareness about Yu Min people, a Southeast Asian ethnic group with origins in China, many of whose members fled from Laos to Thailand and then settled in the United States after the Vietnam War. Quote, "I am born in Laos, but I am not Laotian," Saipan told a news conference Monday at Oregon Lottery headquarters, where his identity of one of the jackpot's winners was revealed. Quote, "I am Yu Maine," unquote. During the Vietnam War, the CIA and U.S. military recruited Yu Maine in neighboring Laos, many of them subsistence farmers, to engage in guerrilla warfare and to provide intelligence and surveillance to disrupt the Ho Chi Minh Trail that the North Vietnamese used to send troops and weapons through Laos and Cambodia into South Vietnam. After the conflict, as well as the Laotian Civil War, when the U.S.-backed government of Laos fell in 1975, they fled by the thousands to avoid reprisals from the new communist government, escaping by foot through the jungle and then across the Mekong River into Thailand, according to a history posted on the website of Yu Maine Community Services in Sacramento, California. More than 70% of the Yu Maine population in Laos left, and many wound up in refugee camps in Thailand. Thousands of the refugees were allowed to come to the United States, with the first waves arriving in the late 1970s, and most settling along the West Coast. The culture had rich traditions of storytelling, basketry, embroidery, and jewelry making, but many, initially, had difficulty adjusting to Western life due to cultural and language differences, as well as a lack of formal education. There are now tens of thousands of Yu Maine, pronounced Yu Maine, in the U.S., with many attending universities or starting businesses. Many converted to Christianity from traditional animist religions. There is a sizable Yu Maine community in Portland and its suburbs, with a Buddhist temple and a Baptist church, active social organization, and businesses and restaurants. Kylie Turn, president of the Yu Maine Association of Oregon, arrived in Portland with his family in 1980 when he was 3 years old. He is now running for city council. Saipan's Powerball win is significant for other Yu Maine, he said. Quote, "It means so much because all of us came with so little," Turn said. "I take pride in seeing our members of the community advance and flourish, and I just feel so good for him, unquote. Saipan, 46, said he was born in Laos and moved to Thailand in 1987 before immigrating to the United States in 1994. He graduated from high school in 1996 and has lived in Portland for 30 years. He worked as a machinist for an aerospace company. He said Monday that he has had cancer for 8 years and had his latest chemotherapy treatment last week. Quote, I will be able to provide for my family and my health, he said, adding that he'd find a good doctor for myself, unquote. Saipan, who has 2 young children, said that as a cancer patient, he wondered, quote, how am I going to have time to spend all of this money? How long will I live, unquote. He said he and his 37-year-old wife, Dwapen, are taking half the money, and the rest is going to a friend, Liza Chow, 55, of Portland suburb of Milwaukee. Chow had chipped in $100 to buy a batch of tickets with them. Chow was on her way to work when Saipan called her with the news, quote, you don't have to go anymore, he said. In the weeks leading up to the drawing, he wrote out numbers for the game on a piece of paper and slept with it under his pillow, he said. He prayed that he would win, saying, quote, I need some help. I don't want to die yet unless I have done something for my family first, unquote. The winning Powerball ticket was sold in early April at a Plaid Pantry convenience store in Portland, ending a winless streak that stretched more than 3 months. The Oregon Lottery said it had to go through a security and vetting process before announcing the identity of the person who came forward to claim the prize. Under Oregon law, with few exceptions, lottery players cannot remain anonymous. Winners have a year to claim the top prize. The jackpot had a cash value of $621 million before taxes if the winner chose to take a lump sum rather than an annuity paid over 30 years, with an immediate payout followed by 29 annual installments. The prize is subject to federal taxes and state taxes. The $1.3 billion prize is the 4th largest Powerball jackpot in history and the 8th largest among U.S. jackpot games, according to the Oregon Lottery. The biggest U.S. lottery jackpot won was $2.04 billion in California in 2022. Judge threatens jail time. Court holds the former president in contempt for violating the gag order. The story came from the Associated Press, and the dateline is New York. Donald Trump was held in contempt of court Tuesday and fined $9,000 for repeatedly violating a gag order that barred him from making public statements about witnesses, jurors, and some others connected to his New York hush money case. If he does it again, the judge warned, he could be jailed. Prosecutors alleged 10 violations, but New York Judge Juan Merkin found there were 9. It was a stinging rebuke of the Republican former president's insistence that he was exercising his free speech rights and a reminder that he's a criminal defendant subject to the harsh realities of trial procedure. Quote, this gag order is totally unconstitutional, Trump said as court adjourned. Merkin wrote that he is keenly aware of and protective of Trump's First Amendment rights, particularly given his candidacy for the office of President of the United States, unquote. Still, he warned that the court would not tolerate willful violations of its lawful orders and that, if necessary and appropriate under the circumstances, it will impose an incarceratory punishment, unquote. Tuesday's ruling came at the start of the second week of testimony in the historic case, in which Manhattan prosecutors argued Trump and his associates took part in an illegal scheme to influence the 2016 presidential campaign by purchasing and then burying seamy stories. The payouts went to a doorman with a torrid yarn, ex-Playboy model Karen McDougal, who had accusations of an affair, and to porn performer Stormy Daniels, who alleged a sexual encounter with Trump. he pleaded not guilty and says the stories are all fake. The judge also announced he will halt the trial on May 17th to allow Trump to attend his son Barron's high school graduation. In other developments, testimony resumed Tuesday with Gary Farrow, a banker who helped former Trump attorney Michael Cohen open accounts, including one that Cohen used to buy Daniels' silence. Jurors also began hearing from Keith Davidson, a lawyer who represented McDougal and Daniels in their negotiations with the National Enquirer and Cohen. He testified that he arranged a meeting at his Los Angeles office to see whether the tabloid's parent company was interested in McDougal's story. The tabloid eventually bought the story. Even as the deal was signed, Davidson testified that he understood McDougal's story would never be published. Drug agency intends to reclassify marijuana. Sources say the move could place cannabis at a lower designation. Story by the Associated Press. Dateline, Washington. The U.S. Drug Enforcement Administration will move to reclassify marijuana as a less dangerous drug. The Associated Press learned, a historic shift to generations of American drug policy that could have wide ripple effects across the country. The DEA's proposal, which still must be reviewed by the White House Office of Management and Budget, would recognize the medical uses of cannabis and acknowledge it has less potential for abuse than some of the nation's most dangerous drugs. It would not federally legalize marijuana for recreational use. The agency's move, confirmed to the Associated Press on Tuesday by five people familiar with the matter who spoke on the condition of anonymity, clears the last significant regulatory hurdle before the agency's biggest policy change in more than 50 years can take effect. Once OMB signs off, the DEA will move marijuana from its current classification as a Schedule I drug, alongside heroin and LSD. It moves pot to Schedule III, alongside ketamine and some anabolic steroids, following a recommendation from the Federal Health and Human Services Department. New Iowa law regulates traffic cameras, which generated $1.16 million for Waterloo in 2023. Dateline, Waterloo. The cities of Waterloo, Old Wine, Hudson, and Independence will have to make their case to state transportation officials to keep traffic cameras under a new law headed for approval. Other cities that want cameras, like Waverly, will have to wait until the summer of 2026 before they set them up and issue tickets under the law, which awaits the governor's signature. Waterloo currently has the most automated traffic enforcement cameras in the state, 23 stationary cameras and two portable units, according to a Legislative Services Agency report. In 2023, Waterloo's cameras issued 53,000 tickets and collected on 26,000 of those tickets. The city received $1.16 million from fines, and another $942,000 went to the vendor who maintains the cameras and processes the tickets, according to the agency's report. Cedar Rapids brought in the most revenue among municipalities, reporting to the agency that $7.2 million from its 19 cameras going to the city and $1.8 million to its vendor. Funds from Waterloo's automated tickets are currently used to pay Axon, the company that provides the body cams and dashboard cameras and operates the systems that compile and catalog footage, with the rest of the money going to the city's general fund. Under changes with the new law, funds from automated tickets will have to be spent on transportation infrastructure or to offset police or fire expenses. The law requires municipalities to receive permits from the Iowa Department of Transportation for the cameras. It also mandates annual reports that show statistics for crashes, citations, and other relevant data for areas where traffic cameras are in place. In addition, the new law sets the trigger for speeding citations at no less than 10 miles per hour over the posted limit. Waterloo's cameras currently issue tickets starting at 12 miles per hour over. Signage requirements are also addressed in the law. And now, listeners, we just take a moment to remind you that you're listening to the reading of the Waterloo Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 1st on IRIS. That's IRIS, the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service for the Blind and the Print Handicapped. Now, let's turn to the opinion section. Our first editorial today was published in the Des Moines Register and was written by the editorial board. Kim Reynolds picked this legislature, and it steamrolled an extreme path for Iowa. The eight-year period since Republicans cemented control of Iowa's executive and legislative branches is an often used and useful shorthand for gauging how the state has changed. But the two-year General Assembly that just wrapped up is at least as useful as a measuring stick. It's the first iteration of the legislature that was literally shaped by Governor Kim Reynolds and her worldview, and she used her influence to change the state in ways that will be difficult to reverse. Iowans should take up that challenge, though, and begin to pull the state back from the extremist pivot on display in the last 2 years. How we get here? Reynolds helped oust incumbents who stalled her private school plan. The GOP has forcefully exerted its will, to be sure, since the first weeks of 2017, when lawmakers and Governor Terry Branstad gutted public union bargaining rights. But in 2022, after Reynolds' proposal for scholarships to bring public school funding to private schools fizzled, the governor raised the demand for fealty to new heights by campaigning against incumbent Republicans she knew had opposed her proposal. Four of them lost their primary elections that June, and other Reynolds-backed candidates won in that election and in November, too. The party picked up 4 seats in the House and 2 in the Senate. In the latter case, that gave the GOP a supermajority of over 2/3 of seats. The ambitious new laws that followed in the 2023 and the 2024 sessions have been remarkable, not just for their scope, but also their sheer number. Tax money pouring into private schools, soon without any income restriction, on the families involved. Complicated new asset tests for eligibility for food benefits and other assistance. An abortion ban as strict and bereft of meaningful exemptions as almost any in the country. The end of dedicated funding streams that for decades paid for area education agencies to assist schools with special education and programming needs. Government reorganization that concentrates authority in the governor's office. Strict limits on new spending by cities and counties. A flat income tax. Repeated instances of lawmakers substituting their judgment for that of professionals, librarians and teachers, on what books and lessons to offer students, and doctors on what treatments to pursue for transgender children. Of course, this is far from a comprehensive list. Large majorities let Republicans pass bills over significant opposition within the party. Reynolds's influence was most direct in securing passage of the, quote, education savings accounts, unquote, for private schools, but the large majorities have allowed Republicans to enact policies even over the objections of their own peers. Over the 2 years, 12 bills have become or are on track to become law, despite at least 5 House Republicans voting against them. 5 bills had 8 or more GOP no votes. Instead of tracking the difficult undertaking of working on problems that were apparent 2 years ago, worsening, expiring COVID-19 aid, a labor shortage, an uncertain future for ethanol, and inadequate nursing home care, the Republican agenda delivered some incomplete solutions, ignored many problems altogether, and created some new problems to boot. instead of pondering how to balance property tax burdens with higher costs for vital local services, the Reynolds legislature just told cities and counties to spend less, instead of truly regulating damaging farm field runoff and spending big on cleaning public waters. The Reynolds legislature declined even to allow watershed management authorities the symbolic step of adding soil health to their missions, instead of working with public school districts to apply additional resources to help children close to COVID widened learning gaps. Legislators started regulating what people can read at school, spent big on handouts to high-income families with children at religious schools, and turned the complex issue of chronic absenteeism into a judicial matter, rather than do something about Iowa's well-earned reputation as unwelcoming amid a worker shortage. The Reynolds legislature slashed child labor restrictions, told police they can start arresting undocumented immigrants, and put all their eggs in the how low can tax rates go basket. Precious few Iowans benefit substantially from all of this. Many other Iowans might see little to no change in their daily lives, but far too many Iowans are left to regard the new policies with suspicion and fear. People who have migrated from other countries or whose appearance suggests they may have done so, people in need of public assistance, people whose choices don't align with conservative Christian views, and now face potential exclusion under a, quote, Religious Freedom Restoration Act, unquote. Reynolds and the legislature can't claim to be crafting bills to answer Iowa's unique needs. Several of the most objectionable laws clearly came from think tanks model legislation, copied the actions of other conservative-run states, or both. On some of the most impactful bills, another effect of the Republicans' supermajority is apparent. It's easier to cut deals out of the public eye and then make a show of accepting public comment before pushing through the original plan. This was most evident with the end-of-session income tax bill, which passed both chambers within 2 days of being introduced, hours after analysis showed it would cost the state treasury $1 billion over 2 years. Even when the public's pushback prompted more reflection, as with remaking special education and diminishing AEAs, the final product hewed closer to where Reynolds started the discussion than to the more modest idea that some House Republicans tried to champion. We've seen enough to know this political makeup is not helping most Iowans. Iowa should wrap up its experiment with extremism and return to state policy that's more broadly beneficial. This is not just because so many people and their futures are being overlooked under Iowa's current leadership. It's also because many of us, frankly, lack the imagination to know what Reynolds's legislature might try to do next. Who predicted this year's attack on the AEAs? The Kim Reynolds chosen legislature has been bad for Iowa. The next election for governor is not until 2026, but voters this fall can elect a legislature that won't so often bend to her will. Lucas Grundmeier on behalf of the Register Editorial Board. This next one comes from the Storm Lake Times Pilot, editor Art Cullen. Starving disease research. Genetic fragments of the avian flu virus have been found in milk, federal authorities reported last week, suggesting that the disease is more widespread among dairy cattle than previously thought. Pasteurized milk is safe to drink because the process neutralizes those viral fragments. Avian flu has been found in dairy herds in 8 states so far, and one dairy worker in Texas was infected. The flu has crossed into other mammals in the wild. Veterinarians are anxious that it could spread to swine, which would be a huge economic disaster. Buena Vista County is familiar with repeated massive poultry culling, the first in 2015, that affected turkeys and laying hens. Dare to imagine if that happens to swine, or humans working with confined livestock. The economic considerations are staggering. The human health implications are troubling, to say the least. Despite these massive losses, partially covered by government indemnity funds, we are woefully unprepared to deal with disease pandemics. Authorities do not fully understand how avian influenza is spreading or its extent. Most of our effort goes to biosecurity, which has not been wholly effective despite rigor. Vaccination is controversial and comes with a cost to producers. Our solutions are limited in a consolidated system that concentrates huge numbers of animals indoors and facilitates transmission. That's why research is vital to our enterprise. Congress has been derelict. Federal funding for animal disease research has been static for over a decade because of budget sequestration imposed following the 2008 financial meltdown. It has just started to recover with a 10% increase in funding over the past 2 years, which does not keep pace with inflation. We budget about $1 billion a year for USDA livestock and plant research. Consider that the poultry industry alone accounted for $76 billion in sales in 2022. We devote a pittance to understanding how disease works. Congress just passed a $95 billion security package for Ukraine, Israel, and Taiwan on a bipartisan basis. It is hard to understand why an imminent threat to our economic and national security, disease, pales in comparison. Our security surely depends on safe livestock and food and healthy food production workers, but we treat it as a fiscal afterthought. A new farm bill is stalled in Congress, held up by radicals in the House who want to snuff out food stamps. Meanwhile, we snuff out millions of chickens at a draw. It will happen again and could strike any day. The question is how bad the next wave is and how long before the flu morphs into other species and how severe it will be. Iowa is a world center for livestock research. Ames is home to the National Animal Disease Lab. This should be an urgent priority for our congressional delegation, which is otherwise occupied with scaring off immigrants or trying to make certain no welfare queen gets free cheese. Buena Vista County is built around livestock. We are especially vulnerable to pandemics. We were the hottest spot in the nation at one point during the early days of the COVID crisis because of the nature of our work. When chickens are exterminated, workers are laid off. When hens can't lay, egg prices rise. We have been studying this virus since 1963 and still don't have our arms around it. If you could build a bomb to blow it up, the Pentagon would have done it by now. Instead, we virtually ignore trying to figure out how to raise 5 million hens or 20,000 turkeys under one roof safely. Perhaps we can't. It could be the nature of the consolidated system itself. We can better understand, then, why corporate interests who control USDA funding are not interested in answers that increase their expenses. That's why we don't vaccinate hens. It's the margin, stupid. Do we really want a comprehensive research effort that concludes the production system itself promotes endemic disease? Given the level of funding, the answer is obvious. The scientists warned us for years before the COVID pandemic that it was coming. What did we do? Reduced research. Then it hit. The scientists are warning us again, now that avian flu has shown up in mammals, that the next pandemic could be brewing. Yet our public funding treats it as a sniffle. Next, from the New York Times, we have How Michigan Ended Minority Rule. This one written by Ari Berman. On April 8th, one day before the Arizona Supreme Court reinstated a ban on abortion from 1864, Donald Trump said the issue of abortion rights should be left to the states and, quote, whatever they decide must be the law of the land, unquote. Mr. Trump's statement and the outcry over the Arizona decision reinforced how state-level policy on issues like abortion can have major national ramifications. Though states' rights have long been a rallying cry for conservatives opposed to the federal government's policies on issues like civil rights and abortion, today the states offer Democrats the best opportunity to protect democracy and expand key rights. For years, Democrats have prioritized federal elections over state ones, but they should look to the states as the most effective avenue for progressive reform, especially since state power is very likely to only increase, even as the federal system is stacked against Democrats. The Electoral College and the Senate are biased toward whiter, more rural, and more conservative areas, while the Supreme Court is a product of those two skewed institutions. The Supreme Court's conservative majority in striking down federal abortion and voting rights has delegated a tremendous amount of authority to the states and unexpectedly given progressive reformers a new opening to protect such rights at the state level. Since overturning the Roe v. Wade, for example, 7 states have voted directly on abortion, and in all 7 states, red and blue alike, abortion rights advocates have won. Michigan is one promising national model for how state-level activists can retake the power of their state governments. This notion would have been laughable a decade ago, after Republicans took control of the state following the 2010 election. Michigan was a bastion of minority rule. Over the course of the decade, Republicans routinely received a minority of votes for the state legislature, but won a majority of the seats thanks to extreme partisan gerrymandering that allowed them to, quote, cram all the Dem garbage, unquote, in the words of one GOP staff member, into as few seats as possible. It was the failure of Michigan's broken political institutions that led to an unlikely movement for reform. 2 days after the 2016 election, dismayed by the Michigan government's detachment from voters, Katie Faley, a 27-year-old political novice from the Grand Rapids area, posted on Facebook before leaving for work, quote, I'd like to take on gerrymandering in Michigan. If you're interested in doing this as well, please let me know, unquote. She added a smiley face emoji for a millennial touch. Ms. Faley founded a group, Voters Not Politicians, to put an initiative on the ballot calling for an independent citizens commission instead of the state legislature to draw new political districts. Within 110 days, 428,000 signatures had been collected with the help of more than 4,000 volunteers, many recruited through social media, and no paid staff members, a rare feat in Michigan history. In 2018, 61% of voters approved their ballot initiative. The same year, the state chapters of the ACLU, League of Women Voters, and the NAACP spearheaded another ballot initiative, which was passed by 67% of voters, that greatly expanded voter access in the state through policies like automatic and election day registration and no-excuse absentee voting. 4 years later, the two coalitions came together again to pass a third ballot initiative expanding early voting and combating election subversion after Mr. Trump's 2020 attempt to overturn the presidential vote in the state. The new law requires election results to be certified with no interference from partisans. Voters also approved ballot initiatives legalizing recreational marijuana in 2018 and enshrining the right to reproductive freedom in the state constitution in 2022. Those pro-democracy measures transformed Michigan politics. In 2022, Democrats flipped control of the legislature for the first time in 40 years after the distribution of seats finally followed the popular vote totals under new maps drawn by the Citizens Redistricting Commission. The state set a record for voter turnout in a midterm, with the highest participation rate among young voters in the country. With the help of Governor Gretchen Whitmer, a Democrat, Michigan became a blueprint for how a state can shift from minority rule to majority rule. Direct democracy, a crucial tool used in Michigan to expand democratic rights, is not a panacea. Only roughly half the states offer ballot initiatives, and even in those that do, lawmakers frequently try to undermine them by making it harder to get such initiatives on the ballot through onerous signature requirements and other red tape, or by raising the bar needed to approve them from simple majorities to supermajorities. From 2010 to 2022, state-level Republicans introduced 255 bills seeking to restrict the ballot initiative process. Quote, "You put very sexy things like abortion and marijuana on the ballot, and a lot of young people come out and vote," the former Republican Senator Rick Santorum complained in November 2023 after Ohio voters rejected an attempt to undercut the initiative process. Still, state constitutions were specifically designed to be a majoritarian counterweight to the counter-majoritarian features of America's national political institutions. States like Michigan, Ohio, and Arizona that allow citizen-led ballot initiatives offer a pathway toward expanding democracy that is currently foreclosed on the federal level, barring a huge national movement for systemic reform. State constitutions empower popular majorities in ways that the federal Constitution does not. Unlike the U.S. Constitution, the Michigan Constitution can be amended by voters through a simple majority vote and has been rewritten 3 times through state constitutional conventions since its drafting in 1835, most recently in 1963. That Constitution reflects the values of the civil rights movement, including protections against racial discrimination and safeguarding civil and political rights. Of course, the fact that state institutions are more responsive to popular majorities than the federal Constitution, which was designed in part to limit democratic participation, means they can swing in both directions. In recent years, some states like Michigan and Wisconsin have shifted to the left, while others such as North Carolina have moved right. Pitched partisan battles are being waged over previously obscure and relatively apolitical institutions, like state Supreme Courts, as the stakes have grown. Republicans currently control state legislatures in 28 states, and while Democrats have little chance of winning in some of the reddest areas, the Michigan model is a potential testing ground for other purple states like Arizona, Georgia, New Hampshire, and Wisconsin, where Republicans hold majorities in the legislature despite President Biden's carrying the state in 2020. The protection of key rights at the state level has major implications for 2024. Organizing around important state-level democracy issues, rolling back gerrymandering, expanding ballot access, and combating election subversion, passing state constitutional amendments, could also aid Democrats nationally. These efforts would engage more voters and remind them that they have a voice in the political process. And when state governments become more responsive to the will of the people, voters come to see that there's a real point to voting and will be more willing to turn out in presidential elections too. This can benefit Democratic candidates by boosting turnout among the disaffected liberals who stopped participating in their local elections, convinced that their vote wouldn't make a difference because Republicans had so rigged the system. Restoring legitimacy to the democratic process is one of the fundamental lessons Michigan has to offer. Here's a note about the author of this opinion piece, Ari Berman, is the National Voting Rights Correspondent at Mother Jones and the author of Minority Rule, The Right-Wing Attack on the Will of the People, and the fight to resist it. Iowa homeowners age 65 and up are eligible for state tax exemption. Dateline Waterloo. Homeowners aged 65 or older are eligible for a property tax exemption worth $3,250 for the assessment year beginning January 1st of 2023. In subsequent years, the exemption will double to $6,500. The exemptions are a reduction in the taxable value of the property, not a direct reduction of how much property taxes a homeowner pays, according to a news release from the City of Waterloo's Finance Department. On May 4, 2023, Governor Kim Reynolds signed House File 718, establishing this homestead tax exemption. The Iowa Department of Revenue has amended the homestead tax credit and exemption to allow claimants to apply for the new exemption. Applications are due July 1st to your local assessor. If granted, the exception will be allowed for future years without future filing, as long as the claimant continues to qualify. To apply for the tax exemption, download and fill out the tax-exempt form by going to the website or contact the Black Hawk County Assessor's Office. And now, listeners, that's going to do it for today's reading of the Waterloo-Cedar Falls Courier for Wednesday, May 1st. I'm your volunteer reader, Bob Young. Remember, you can listen to a recording of this reading of the Courier or of the other newspapers around the state that we read. Just visit our website, iowaradioreading.org, at any time. And we want to thank you for listening to your IRIS, Iowa's first and only radio reading service.